Hello, and welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Many thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on. Remember to consider joining as a member to help support Turkey Book Talk. Membership gives you various extra benefits and content. Paying members get access to a range of extra things, including full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which so far amounts to over 60 conversations. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hürriyet Daily News, but nowadays a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. And the archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey and Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles and have made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast in the past, and there will be more in the future, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do become a member, you'll have my sincere gratitude, and most importantly, you'll be helping us develop the podcast. If more people join in due course, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, or by doing a quick Google search, or by looking at any of the other podcast pages. At present, we post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up being able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum for 4 episodes. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome, but as long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now let's get on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Cengiz Erişen. He's an associate professor at Istanbul's Yeditepe University and the author of Political Behavior and the Emotional Citizen, Participation and Reaction in Turkey, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan. The book is based on research focusing on the months between the June 2015 and November 2015 elections. This was a landmark period in which the ruling AKP lost its parliamentary majority, a peace process broke down with the PKK, attacks by ISIS and the PKK shook the country, coalition talks failed, and the AKP ended up regaining its parliamentary majority in a re-election. Erişen argues in the book that the return of many voters to the AKP in November 2015 was largely motivated by rising nationalism amid clashes with the PKK and a hope for stability. This is obviously a particularly timely conversation as we're currently in the middle of an unexpectedly interesting snap election campaign. We talk a bit later on about how the campaign is going so far, the surprisingly strong performance of main opposition candidate Muharrem İnce, and the critical importance of the Kurdish issue. But I started by asking Cengiz Erişen to talk about how his research on emotional engagement in politics applied specifically to the period between the June 2015 and November 2015 elections.
So my intention was actually to figure out the role of emotions in Turkish political behavior across various domains. I did not expect to have snap elections, as you mentioned, on November 2015. But my expectation was to get on the field right after the June elections in 2015 and then see the reactions of the public. It just coincided with a number of things in Turkish politics in those days, a number of things were going on, and they were all emotionally loaded. And among all, I would say that fear of instability was the most critical factor for their ultimate vote decision, because the level of threat perception on terror and negotiations with PKK or anything that is associated with the Kurdish opening, economic crisis growing as a concern, unemployment being a factor, These all add up to the level of uncertainty in the political system. Now, when the level of uncertainty is high or the risk of instability is high, then people are more likely to feel anxious of the general political scene and less likely to take any risks, less likely to trust each other, and more likely to side with the safe bet political leader or party. So that was, I believe, what went in the summer months of 2015. People wanted to find refuge, a secure place, and Erdogan was the charismatic leader that would provide this security. But as you stated, that was an important summer for Turkish politics.
Now, obviously, Turkish politics is based around really quite foregrounded kind of identity questions, really, religious identity, ethnic identity, nationalism. And these seem peculiarly geared towards more emotional responses, really, more associated with primal sentiments. And this is also kind of reflected, I feel, a bit in the sense that, you know, politics is almost entirely really about sort of rallying around charismatic leaders and various kind of social, cultural identifiers. And it seems that, you know, really for years now, it's been locked in this kind of situation where parties are really about sort of expressing group identities, social identities, not so much economic identities. Policy and ideology is really sort of in the background a lot of the time. There's a kind of centrality of identity in politics in Turkey, which really does sort of heighten the emotional angle.
That is quite an important finding or assessment. And I don't think Turkey is alone in the analysis or the importance of group identities meaning more than economic or political identities. This has been shown in the US as well. Group attachment is becoming more important than policy preferences. In-group, out-group differentiation is so powerful that it overwhelms the rational assessments. The simpler way to understand this is, what is my in-group? So who do I associate politically? So, and regarding on my in-group, what is the out-group? And how much dislike do I have towards the preferences or followers of the out-group? It's as simple as that, and it has been working quite powerfully in recent years. Identity formation is extremely effective, and the division of the public as my group versus the other group makes things simpler in political terms. And Erdogan has been able to do this quite effectively for the last 5 years at least. And Gezi was sort of the turning point for him to find his core base and work on that base. And but Turkey is not alone in terms of understanding how group-based politics work. When you look at far-right political parties across Europe or in Trump's world, in the United States, polarization is a reality. And precedent factor for polarization, in my opinion, is group-based politics.
You mentioned there that, like, inherently in this kind of group formation, there's always an out-group. Kind of struck me as I was reading, you know, even when someone like Erdogan, the president, is kind of, all his speeches are about sort of, he often praises kind of development of his, that his government has overseen, you know, infrastructure projects, all that. And whenever he does that, it's always a double-edged sword, because he always contrasts it with the kind of feckless others and kind of inherently dismisses them as saying, you know, these are, you know, these others would never be able to do this, you know, oversee these grand projects that I'm doing. So even when you're talking about something kind of very dry, like you know, infrastructure development and hospitals and whatnot, is kind of weaved into this broader narrative of identity formation, and it's inherently polarizing in a way. One of the other things that always strikes me when thinking about Turkish politics is this importance. It's not often remarked on as being kind of unique, but it does seem to me a very distinctive feature of Turkish politics, which is this the importance of you know, these mass public rallies that every party does. Basically, the party will take over this kind of main square or public space somewhere across the country. They set up a big stage, and then the main event will be this kind of demagogic speech, really, delivered by the leader to the crowd. And obviously, you know, during an election campaign, that is basically what election campaigning is. It's just touring the country and trying to get media coverage in that way. Often these rallies are kind of highly choreographed affairs, really, you know, especially with the AKP. They'll use the full force of the state, really, you know, using local municipal workers and whatnot, people bussed in from elsewhere or given some kind of incentive to attend. But these rallies really do kind of exemplify Turkish politics, really, at its most emotional. You know, it's really where all the emotions are stirred, the direct connection between the leader and the crowds cheering them on. And it seems like a very distinguishing kind of feature, really, of Turkish politics, particularly, you know, of course, we're in the middle of a snap election campaign at the moment. So these things are very visible every time you turn on the TV. Have rallies always had this importance in Turkish politics? I mean, you see pictures and videos of Ecevit and Süleyman Demirel also speaking at these rallies, you know, holding, you know, about five microphones in their hand. Have they always had this kind of very prominent role in Turkish politics, or has it become more kind of systemized over time?
No, I think they've become a lot more important over time. There are several reasons. First, again, the election is an important one. It's not just a regular election. It was taken 18 months prior to the scheduled date, and sort of a snap election. And the opposition was sort of found itself facing the challenges of getting ready for the election. So that's one thing. The other one is social media. And Turkey is one of the Turkish public highly consumes social media, and they communicate through Twitter, Facebook, and other means. So I think this sort of improved the ability to show up and participate in these rallies. So I think when compared to the Ecevit time or Süleyman Demirel era or the 1990s, there's obviously a huge difference in terms of how much people care about elections and participating in these rallies and political campaigns. So I think it's a combination of both something that is going on at the international level, but also at the national level specific for Turkey.
And we're talking in the middle of an election, in the middle of a campaign for this snap election that was brought forward 18 months. It's been quite a surprising campaign period, really. I think when the election was called over a month ago, there was a lot of people thinking it was just a foregone conclusion and everything was seen. The opposition was in complete disarray. But there's been a strange kind of dynamic, really. The opposition parties kind of galvanized. There was a lot of different kind of scenarios that were being talked about. In the end, the main opposition party, the CHP, opted to nominate Muharrem Ince, who's putting in a very energetic performance. He's doing these rallies, you know, across the country, and he's speaking quite in an engaging way, very spontaneous. He's coming out with all kinds of things. I saw him earlier today. He had a picture of a map, a world map, showing people at his rally where the imports for meat were coming from, and he was talking about how farming in Turkey and had been destroyed, and criticizing the government's agricultural policies, and that kind of thing really wasn't expected just over a month ago, really. It's kind of come out of nowhere, and it's made the campaign a little bit more interesting than it looked like it would be. I just wonder if there's anything that surprised you about this present campaign, any particular reflections that you have about how your research kind of reflects interestingly on the current campaign.
Yes, yeah, I agree with you that it is going really interesting. The opposition parties are gaining more traction in the public. Most important of all, Ince is actually gaining more interest in the public. And his way of illustrating certain complex issues in a simple way is extremely efficient in regard that people need to see how our economy is being influenced by certain decisions taken by the current government. So he's attacking the government on critical issues that matter to the person on the street. Just as you mentioned, today he's talking about where Turkey imports the meat from, or he wants to show that we are not self-sustaining ourselves in terms of meat, not to mention the price of meat, which directly influences the level of meat consumption for a regular Turkish citizen. It's extremely expensive, and people are having difficulty buying this, you know, basic product that they need to consume as a family. And so he's addressing these important issues that need to be solved. And he's, I think, doing a good job in terms of creating this attention on these issues and that reflect or that relate to the daily lives of citizens. So considering that he just started doing this over the last 3 weeks or maybe a month, actually, I think he's gaining a lot of interest in the public. Same for Akşener and Temel Karamollaoğlu. They're all sort of speaking with the same language and trying to reach out to the public to the extent that AKP has not been able to address perhaps for the last couple of years in particular. And so we are not sure what it will look like in terms of the results at the moment, but what matters most is the undecided or the voter in the middle or medium voter. So we want to figure out that group of middle voter base and what would motivate them to vote for one group versus the other. And I think this is building up in the public, and economic downturn, you know, the currency exchange rate is a big deal right now affecting everyone on the street, and some other issues with respect to Syria, other factors that might work against the hand of the current government. They're all going to build up this interest in the opposition side. Most importantly, again, the medium voter or the voter who is undecided at the moment.
I still think Ince has this massive uphill task, almost an impossible task, looking at the odds stacked against him. But I think I've been among those who've been very surprised and impressed, really, by the campaign that he's running. Like when he was nominated, I think most people thought he's somebody who's going to motivate the CHP base, you know, secularist, kind of populist style, but really not kind of threaten the government in any way. But one of the things that he's done over the last few weeks that has been impressive is that it's interesting, here we're talking about like social groups, identities and how important they are. He's really sought to try and just move beyond those. He's not hammering this old style CHP message. He's really kind of looking out. He's really emphasizing the economy. He's speaking in this kind of everyman way. He's you can't really place him left or right. He's just using this very natural style, and it's seems to be quite a successful snap campaign that he's running in a way. It's interesting in a way that he's kind of a symbol, really, surprisingly enough, of this moving perhaps beyond, or trying at least to move beyond narrow kind of group identities, which are so dominant in Turkish politics anyway.
Well, in order to be successful in any democracy, you have to target the medium voter. And I think Ince is quite aware of that fact. And since the beginning of his campaign, he's focused on that person in the medium, standing in the medium, because he and CHP, I think, pretty much know that if they do not target that particular group, they will not have any chance improving their vote share. So, and Ince is sort of really positioned himself as a presidential candidate. So he's not only voicing CHP needs for the CHP base, but also he said from the first day that I'm going to be president of everyone in Turkey. So that takes you towards the center. And as you mentioned, that he's not dealing with the, let's say, old school debates all the time. I think that's how he has gained more interest over the last 3 weeks. That we still don't know, I mean, what the results will look like. Again, this is all hypothetical at the moment, but we'll see in a few weeks.
I don't know, I feel a bit like his success is in a way kind of differentiating himself from the CHP. Like, I can imagine people voting for him who wouldn't vote for the CHP in the parliamentary election. I don't know, I guess we'll find out in 3 weeks, but seems like that's the kind of dynamic that's working for him at the moment. He's kind of injected a new kind of energy. Like, when you watch him, he's kind of very funny in a way. Like, people engage, people laugh, he kind of engages with the crowd. And what's quite striking is that Erdogan, for the last few years, has just completely dominated the political landscape in a way, and there's been this kind of sense, really, of a kind of immovable wall. And while he's still completely dominant and has this kind of psychological hegemony still, you get the feeling that, like, he seems a bit flat-footed at the moment. Like, he's looking older and he's looking very kind of scripted, and somebody comes along with a bit more energy in the opposition, like Ince, and you start to see, you know, Erdogan's kind of looking a bit tired now. And I don't know how I doubt actually it's going going to have a huge effect on vote rates, but it does change the kind of political dynamics in a way. In the long run, you start to be able to kind of imagine. I think part of the reason why the opposition's kind of more energized now is that almost subconsciously they can start to almost imagine for themselves a kind of post-Erdogan era, which previously was completely unimaginable. Until about a month ago, it was completely unimaginable. But just this sense of being able to imagine this kind of world beyond Erdogan is quite energizing in itself if you're a critic of him.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, being in power for more than a decade is tiring for any individual, regardless whether it's Erdogan or someone else. And it has drawbacks, mostly for the individual, because he or she has been in power for a long time, and the level of, let's say, obedience in quotation marks is extremely, will extremely be higher. So Erdogan has been a charismatic leader for a long time, and he's perhaps observing that he's getting older and a little tired, but also he has not the same team as before. So looking at his team, you don't see the previously, you know, star economy supporters or advisors on certain issues. And the movement in the party is getting slower, that it used to be much faster, perhaps much more effective in previous years. And also the coup attempt and aftermath has been disastrously tiring and troublesome for many. And what is going to come out of that process is still unknown. So I think everything adds up. Maybe he's also feeling tired, but the base, AKP base and Erdogan base is quite strong. And maybe Ince is going to do better in the second round, but we have to first see that Ince passes 30% threshold in terms of presidential vote, and that will then motivate greater support from other opposition party bases towards him in the second round of the election. So I think you're right, but again, some of which relates to Erdogan himself and some relate to the context that Turkish politics has been going through.
Now, going back to the research in the book, obviously you look at this period between June 2015 and November 2015, and one of the, well, probably the main motivation behind this kind of swing back to the AKP was this sense of instability that built up in those months. And I wonder if in the current election, maybe there's something, maybe a similar dynamic could actually happen, because there's been this kind of building narrative really about economic trouble, and the kind of plunging value of the lira has been very alarming indeed. There's also, I think, importantly, this sense that really the economic crisis hasn't yet hit fully, but it is inevitably going to do so at some point in the near future. So I don't know, speculating a bit here, but it seems possible to kind of hypothesize really that this may actually kind of benefit the current government in a way, because people are kind of expecting instability in the near future, and they're anticipating economic trouble in particular. So the kind of voters that we're talking about, who may be sort of persuadable or floating voters somewhere in the middle, who are inclined to the AKP but could theoretically consider an alternative, maybe they'll be less inclined to do that, because that involves taking a risk on an alternative that you may not know. So I think the kind of dynamic that I'm getting at here is like this November 2015 dynamic, where there was this instability and people just flocked back to the AKP. So even if the current government is responsible for this instability, people are much more comfortable psychologically sort of returning to them as this kind of safe harbor, because when you're anticipating instability in the future, or you're anticipating more economic turbulence, you're, I suggest, kind of less likely to take a risk in a way. So I don't know, the narrative is that the more economic turbulence you have, the worse it is for the government, but there might be a kind of reverse psychology effect as well at work. I don't know, I guess we'll find out in 3 months. But
I mean, comparison in one way to 2015 is relevant, but in another it's not. The first thing is that in 2015, although the economic trouble was gaining importance, it was not as big as what we are facing today in terms of plunging lira, the value of lira. And second, there is a difference in terms of economic anxiety versus security anxiety. And the level of security concerns back in 2015 summer was extremely high, and when compared to the economic concerns, because there was a city level strife of PKK terrorists in Turkey and in several cities in the southern and southeastern part of the country. So that we don't have today. For instance, the economic trouble that is critical today. And I think it's palpable in large majority of the public that if that anger is going to gain more power or strength over the last 3 weeks, that's going to benefit the opposition, certainly. But again, if someone is a floating water, unknown of the consequences of voting for something that it hasn't been tried before, then that person is going to choose the incumbent government or Erdogan. These are just my hunches, as you can tell. We'll see. I mean, Turkey is an interesting place, and we'll see how it goes.
We've spoken about rallies and the importance of them, and coincidentally, really, with earlier today, on the day that we're speaking, Selahattin Demirtas, the leader of the Kurdish-focused HDP, he broadcast a campaign rally from a prison telephone, because he's been in jail, obviously, since the end of 2016, and talking more generally about this question of emotions motivating politics. Obviously, perhaps the most emotionally charged issue of all for decades, really, is the Kurdish issue on both sides. You know, it's been an open wound for decades. It's seen the loss of tens of thousands of lives, and it's really kind of obviously violently disrupted the social fabric. Just wondered if you could reflect for us a bit on how that is reflected in the research that you did and what it can tell us about the current campaign as well.
Sure. Excellent question. So let me also start by giving a context regarding Selahattin Demirtas. When I did my study back in 2015, he appeared as a very charismatic leader for the HDP Kurdish base, and almost as powerful as Erdogan appearing to his base. So he appeared, Demirtas appeared as an important leader in the Turkish political scene. And besides the HDP passing 10% threshold in the first June elections in 2015 was a breakthrough moment for the Kurds. And since then, they tried to achieve the same performance in the following elections. Now, given the Kurdish issue, and as you mentioned that it has a long history with lots of negative emotions, so it's obviously an important moment because in the upcoming elections, if the HDP again passes the 10% threshold, then there will be a different math in terms of votes and seats distribution. So it is a critical game-changing situation for the HDP voters. And knowing that Selahattin Demirtas is in prison right now, that is sort of an anger-motivating factor for the HDP voters towards showing greater support for their party. But adding on that, while some people will be motivated by this fact, since Demirtas has no coverage in media, then people who might be willing to vote for HDP are more reluctant at the moment. So they're not able to understand what the party stands for and whether, as it was perceived back in 2015, are they accusing PKK of the terrorist acts and differentiating itself from the terrorist group or not. So those things are unclear. But what we know is that for the parliamentary ballot, if HDP passes the threshold, it's going to change the parliamentarian math. So we'll see what's going to happen soon.
Yes, it really does seem it's, you know, all the other calculations that are being made for the election really do basically hinge on the fact, on whether the HDP crosses the 10% threshold, because if it doesn't, the AKP will sweep up those seats in the southeast and basically guarantee its majority. So, you know, it's an absolutely critical issue. You also touched there on the media question. I've noticed just over the last couple of days, really, there's been a very clear sense I've noticed in the kind of mainstream news channels, which, of course, are very important. Because, you know, we often forget that in this age of social media and the internet, still, according to various surveys, TV news is where most people get their information from. And to be honest, there's been a really significant and very noticeable, compared with previous years, kind of blackout, really, of the opposition. Previously, it was quite surprising, you know, last week, quite how many of Muharrem İnce's rallies were being broadcast on these mainstream stations. But the last couple of days, it seems like there's been a very conscious blackout. In a way, I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It looks really striking how that's happened.
Well, it's easy to understand, you know, if there is a good review of all the last, you know, 2 months and analyzed for the primetime news media amount of which party receiving how many minutes of coverage and what's been exactly covered, because not every coverage is positive. So the content and the amount of coverage should be studied. But as you mentioned, I think social media plays a big role in terms of giving short pieces of or small pieces of information to the public. And it has been shown across different countries that social media works to give small pieces of information, but it doesn't change people's perceptions or preferences too much. But again, yes, this, I think there has to be scientific study of who received what amount of coverage and what was the content of the coverage after perhaps everything is done in a few weeks.
That was Cengiz Evicen, many thanks to him. If you're interested in more pre-election stuff, go over to armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, where I've put up a link to an article I did last week for World Politics Review, taking a slightly longer view of social changes in Turkey and the limits of government control. Hopefully you'll find that quite interesting. Please do remember also to consider supporting Turkey Book Talk by joining as a member. All you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via the Turkey Book Talk Patreon page. Membership gives you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 60 conversations so far. You also get exclusive access to a special 30% discount on over 200 books from the Turkey and Ottoman History series published by IB Taurus. As a member, you'll be helping Turkey Book Talk keep the show on the road, develop further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. And if we get enough members, we may be able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. Find links to the Patreon account in order to sign up via all the Turkey Book Talk websites. And many thanks to all current members, it's very much appreciated. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to William John Armstrong @gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.